ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land, where we are ringing in the new year with some of our favourite stories from the year that was. Later in the show, the life and work of Emily Carmen Guare, one of the greatest painters this country has ever produced, who, in her 70s, in a tiny community in the Northern Territory, became a superstar of our art world. But first, moments after taking off from Logan International early one evening in October 1960, Eastern Airlines Flight 375 plunged into Boston Harbour. 62 passengers were killed. Clogged in the engines of the wreck were the pulverised remains of birds, and these culprits had to be identified. So a call was made to that great American scientific institution, the Smithsonian, where the task was assigned to Roxy Laybourne, a tiny, surly woman, already in her 50s, with thick glasses, grey hair, and a southern drawl. After the Boston plane crash, Roxy Laybourne became the world's foremost forensic ornithologist, investigating not only air crashes but major crimes, poaching by billionaire moguls, murders, tar and feathering by the Ku Klux Klan. When feathers were at a crime scene, Roxy would get a call. The life of Roxy Laybourne is the subject of a new biography by the award-winning journalist Chris Sweeney. It's called The Feather Detective. Chris joins me from Boston. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chris, you had outrageous fun writing this biography, didn't you?
I sure did. It was a trip. I knew I was onto a good story, but I didn't really know how good it was until I got into Roxy's archives and started understanding the true scope of cases and disasters that she investigated over the years.
Let's look first to that initial crime investigation. Why was it of any use to the airline to know what birds had brought the plane down?
Yeah, so this was 1960, and it was kind of the golden age of flight. Commercial airlines were just starting to really take off and have mass appeal. Pilots and aviation insiders always knew that birds were a problem. Going back to the Wright brothers, even one of the Wright brothers struck a bird once during a flight. So insiders knew birds posed a bit of a threat, but nobody really understood how significant a threat they posed until this airplane crashed into Boston Harbor and killed dozens of people. And so as the industry looked around, and more importantly, as the regulators looked around, they said, hey, this is a problem. We need to start figuring out how many birds are being hit by airplanes or how many airplanes are hitting birds. And by the way, are our engines and windshields and, fuselages, are they strong enough to withstand these bird impacts? And there's a pretty big range of weight among all the hundreds of different species of birds. So you need to know what, if you're going to start making bird-proofing your airplanes, you need to know what birds are being hit most frequently and what kind of damage those birds can do. And that's where Roxy Laybourne came in.
And what she was working on was something that's earned the fabulous name Snarge.
Yes, which is a portmanteau of snot and garbage. And what Snarge is, that's what aviation insiders call the remains of birds that they scrape either out of the engines of an airplane or off the side of a wing. Think about it. These airplanes are traveling hundreds of miles per hour. They weigh many thousands of pounds, and they come up on a maybe a gull that weighs a pound or so, and that bird just gets destroyed. There is nothing left. And so when you see the remains, it really does look like snot. It's smeared blood guts with maybe a tiny bit of feather crumpled into it. And Roxy figured out a way to take this tiny fragments of feathers and start identifying the species based on microscopic structures in those tiny fragments.
And what were the birds she discovered brought down that flight?
In that first crash in 1960, it was a flock of European starlings. And those are, they're not a native species here, but they've been here now for a long time. And by some estimates, there was as many as 20,000 birds in that flock that airplane hit. So this was a huge flock of birds or a huge flock of European starlings.
Now, why did she get the job? Why was she at the Smithsonian? Why did they hand this task to her?
Roxy started her career in the 1930s, at the height of the Great Depression, working in a small museum in North Carolina. And there she discovered she was quite a good taxidermist. She was good with a fleshing knife. She could gut a dead animal and prepare it to look rather lifelike after its life had been taken. And so she had spent, about a decade as a taxidermist. In fact, she was the first woman to ever hold a state taxidermy position in North Carolina. And then World War II comes, and the Smithsonian up in Washington, D.C., their workforce gets drained by the war effort. And so there's a job opening. They have this massive bird collection, hundreds of thousands of birds in their research collection at the time. And these birds are falling into a state of disrepair. New birds are coming in. They're not being prepared properly for the museum. And so Roxy is kind of called up to the Smithsonian, gets a job offer there to come work for a year or two as a taxidermist while the men are off fighting. And so she had this intimate knowledge of birds. So she spent, at this point, dozens of years now preparing, handling, intimately looking at dead birds. So she got a feel for their feathers in a way that you just can't by being a bird watcher or a casual observer of birds. And then when this airliner went down, they sent the remains to actually Roxy's boss. But he knew, he said, Roxy's got the determination, the work ethic, and the focus to figure out how to do this. Nobody had taken these tiny bits of fragments of feathers before and identified them or put a species to them. But he believed that Roxy had the kind of grit and the know-how of handling feathers and developing science to do this work. And lo and behold, she got very good at it, and she worked on thousands of airplane strikes over the years and then started working on crime investigations.
Chris, you use terms like determination, focus, grit. There might be another way of describing the personal qualities of Roxy Laybourn.
She was ornery. She was not an easy yes. person. She put work above everything else, including her family. She let her relationships with her sons she sacrificed her relationships with her son. She admitted later in life that she was probably a bad mother. She often stayed at the museum 12, 14-hour days, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days. Her first husband was an abusive alcoholic who she left. Second husband, who she had a child with out of wedlock, died not too long after. So she suffered through a lot, but she also, that maybe gave her some sharp elbows. She also had to deal with some really brutish men in middle management. You can imagine 1950s, 1960s being a woman in the world of birding. It was pretty rare. And so she endured a lot of sexism. And as she kind of sharpened her expertise and really became, the feather detective, she got she gained the ability to push back on some of this, and she figured out a way to work on her terms, and she wasn't afraid of being combative with upper management if she needed to.
I think you can tell a lot about Roxy Laybourn just by listening to her voice. This is a snatch of her talking about the business of identifying feathers.
You have to know breast feathers from back feathers, underwing coverts from upper wing coverts, and feathers around the legs, all that you must know. and learn where the feathers come from. So that way you'll be able to identify the type feathers you're dealing with.
You just get this sense of a woman hunched over a workbench there, don't you? Telling everybody to get out of her way and stay out of her way.
And just that Southern drawl, you know, she was from the Deep South, and I believe that recording was made when she was well into her late 80s, and it just, that Southern drawl never diminished with age, and it's lovely to listen to.
Southern drawl leads us to one of the crimes she solved. Tell us about the tarring and feathering of R. Wiley Brownlee.
This is a crazy case, and you know, it really shows a lot about American history and about Roxy. So Mr. Brownlee was a high school principal out in the suburbs of Detroit, which was in Michigan over here, 1970s. He's trying to get his school district to recognize Martin Luther King Day. And there was a school board meeting about this topic, and Mr. Brownlee spoke passionately about it in favor of recognizing Dr. King. He's driving home on a country road that night, and a car pulls up behind him. And then suddenly another car pulls up to his side and cuts him off and slams on the brakes. So he's boxed in. He looks around, and out walk several men in KKK-style hoods and robes, one carrying a gun. He gets slammed in the head, dropped to the ground, and slowly these guys pour a bunch of cold tar over him, then cut open a pillow and shake all the feathers out. They take his car keys and leave him on the side of the road. So this poor civil rights activist and high school principal gets literally tarred and feathered, thrown on the side of the road in rural Michigan.
What happens next?
The police show up, and they have some suspects in mind. They think they know who might have done this. And so they start poking around, and lo and behold, they find a feather stuck to the bottom of one of the suspect's boots. And then they go and they collect lint out of the drying machine of another suspect and look for feathers in that. And then they collect these guys' pillows and even take some feathers out of their pillows from their house. And they ship them to this guy in Michigan that they're working with, this scientist who's employed by the state of Michigan. The guy can't do anything with these feathers. So I found this old newspaper article where the police say, hey, we have suspects, but the prosecutors can't figure out how to do a feather matchup. They cannot show that these feathers that we recovered from this guy's boot, we can't match them. We can't prosecute these guys. And so after weeks of just standstill, somebody called somebody, and then they say, hey, there's this woman in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian. She's the feather detective. Name's Roxy Layborn. Write to her and send her the feathers. So then in comes Roxy. She gets the evidence, and she looks at all these feathers, and she says, you know, puts them under her microscope and shows that the microscopic structures of these feathers taken off of R. Wiley Brownlee are the same as the feather, you know, taken off one of the suspect's boots, and are same as one of the feathers from the pillows in the suspect's house. And now the feds can bring a case. They can say, they can go and make the arrest. And they did. And they got, you know, these four guys arrested, all members of this offshoot of the KKK. And it went to trial, and they won. You know, these guys were found guilty of tarring and feathering the civil rights activist. By an all-white jury, that's right. And, you know, but without Roxy's identifying these feathers and showing that they were the same, they would have never had a case. These guys would have gotten away with it.
Here is Roxy giving her advice on how to present a case to a jury.
If you're testifying, once you raise your hand and are sworn in to tell nothing but the truth, you are no longer you. You are an actor, and your audience is that jury. You don't try to impress the jury that you are a great scientist or anything. All you want them to realize that you have studied the material. You know what you're talking about.
This is ABC Radio National Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Chris Sweeney about this gorgeous life of the feather detective that he has written. Chris, She was, as that grab shows, very responsible expert witness. And there was a case that she got involved in the city of Belfast in Maine, where she was very disturbed about her capacity to give convincing evidence because she found the whole town was full of feathers.
That's right. So, you know, this is a murder case. This is actually the first time Roxy was ever asked to testify in a murder case. And this, it was a horrible scene. A poor woman in her 70s, cops found her smothered to death. Somebody had broken into her house at night, smothered her with a pillow with such force that the pillow burst and it left feathers up the victim's nose, down her throat, all over her bed. And then the police found a trail of feathers leading from the bedroom down the basement, and they found the basement door unlatched. And so they suspected that whoever murdered this woman by smothering her with a pillow got covered in feathers and went running off into the woods. It also happened that Belfast, Maine, was at the time considered the chicken capital of the United States, or, you know, some people called it the chicken capital of the world. It was a massive amount of chicken farms and two enormous processing plants where, you know, chickens were just sent to slaughter, but all throughout the town there were chicken feathers blowing around. People at the time recalled you get on the highway, you drive, and you just see trucks with crates of chickens and feathers blowing out of them. Roxy wakes up the morning she's supposed to testify, walks out of her hotel room, looks down on the ground, and there's a chicken feather. Man, did that send a lot of stress through her stomach. So she's starting to wonder, you know, oh boy, there's, you know, this is a lot. But she had the evidence. She had been given evidence collected. The person who the police believe that committed the murder had feathers on him when he was apprehended. They took those feathers off. They had sent them to Roxy. She compared them with feathers collected from the victim's mouth. Again, looking at the microscopic characteristics, and she said, bingo, these are the same type of feathers. These came from the same type of bird. But this case, you know, it was the first murder case she ever testified in. The stakes could not have been higher. And this was small town Maine. And it was a tough case. And to be honest, she didn't win. The jury, for some reason, they voted not guilty, completely not guilty, and they let this guy go. And I tracked down the prosecutor in this case 50 years afterwards. He's still upset. He's like, can't believe, he said, Roxy's testimony was absolutely spot on. You know, this was a grave injustice that this guy was let go. And sometimes, you know, as he said, sometimes you win, sometimes you don't know what the jury's thinking. So that was just a wild case.
Is that why she came to the view? She said, you know, I don't like doing crimes of violence. Is it perhaps because she always wanted scientifically sure results and a damn jury can, you know, can rough that up?
Damn jury can rough it up, as can, you know, prosecutors can botch a case or make the wrong argument. And then when she's on the stand, and whether it's a murder trial or burglary or whatever these violent crimes are, the defense attorney over, you know, their whole job is to undermine Roxy. So every time she was put on a stand, she was just being ruthlessly attacked by these defense attorneys who were trying to undermine her science. But she never relented, and she won a lot more cases than she lost. And juries often, you know, sided with Roxy because, going back to that clip you just played, she really didn't try to dress it up. She took her a little bit of time, but she became an expert. She really understood how to communicate her wonky science in a way that would resonate with jury members and make sense. And she really got the handle of that. And I think that was a huge, huge bonus for law enforcement.
Did DNA make Roxy irrelevant? Did you still need a Roxy Laybourn once you had DNA?
You do, especially with the airplane strikes, because oftentimes there's not enough material to get enough functional DNA to run through a sequencer when you're dealing with some of these snarg samples that are collected. So Roxy's where she was at in the Smithsonian, there's now a feather ID lab. It's run by Roxy's protege, a woman named Carla Dove, which is a great last name for a person who runs a feather ID lab.
Oh, poor woman, she must have heard every joke about it. Yes, go on.
She sure has. But no, so I spent a lot of time kind of shadowing Carla and watching her lab work. And about, 60, 70% of the airplane strikes, they process about 11,000 bird strikes a year, both for the Air Force and for commercial airliners. And so about 60, 70% of that, I believe, is done DNA real quick. You know, they got the material, they got a good genetic amount of material, they'll run through a sequencer. But so with the other cases, they still need to do morphology and get the samples out of the research collection and compare the feather or the bit of feather under the microscope with something from the collection. So Roxy's work has been somewhat diminished by DNA, but it has not been replaced.
What exactly was she looking for through the microscope?
If you take a feather in your hand, it has this branching pattern, right? You have the rachis coming up, the main kind of strip, and then you have barbs coming off that. If you take just one of those barbs off and put it under a microscope, you hold it in your hand, it looks like an eyelash maybe. But when you put it under a microscope, this whole world opens up and you see these little cell junctures and these hooks and villi and different nodes. It's incredible because when you hold a barb in your hand, it literally just looks like a little piece of fabric or a strand of feather. But under the microscope, it's this insanely ornate, complex structure. And Roxy figured out that each species, or certainly each family and most species, had really distinct structures under the microscope. So some were wispy and long, some were really packed together. But the more samples she looked at, she came to see, these are distinct patterns among families. And then as she got better and better, she could go down to the species level.
It's kind of extraordinary that she's dealing with airplane crashes and murders and hate crimes of one kind or another. Not so surprising that she worked on poaching cases, including one in the late 1980s involving the billionaire Kluge family. What was that all about? How did she solve that case?
So this is just a wild story. So Kluge, at the time, second richest man in America, he has this giant estate in the state of Virginia and, hundreds of acres. And to entertain his guest, he built a British-style hunting preserve, a pheasant shoot. So that's where you kind of line up, you drink a little champagne, you get a nice hunting rifle, you stand in a station, somebody chases pheasants into the air, and you shoot them, and they call that hunting. And so that's what Kluge had on his property. And his gameskeeper, the people that ran the hunting preserve or the hunting shoot, they took it upon themselves that they were going to shoot every hawk, owl, and bird of prey that they considered a threat to their hunting pheasants. Because, there's a chance an owl might swoop in and grab a pheasant for, dinner. So these guys just massacred dozens of birds of prey, hundreds of birds of prey. And they made a sport out of it. They would clip the feet off and they had an incentive structure where the more hawks you shot and the more owls you shot and killed, maybe you get some bonus pay if you kill a dozen in a day. And so they were slaughtering just hundreds of these birds of prey, all of which are federally protected species over here. You cannot kill these birds. It's completely illegal. And they were killing hundreds of them and chucking them in a pit. They also shot neighbors' dogs. They even killed one of the local police officers' dogs and threw it in the pit. And they found that out when they were clearing out the pit, when they raided the property. They said, this has the sheriff's phone number on it, the collar. And so that's how the sheriff learned his dog was killed there. So they raid John Kluge's property. And they found two kill pits, and these were literally just giant holes dug in the ground with all these dead decomposing birds thrown in them. And so Roxy, often, almost all the time, 99% of the time, the cases Roxy was investigating, she did her portion of work in the Smithsonian in her laboratory. But they couldn't do that for this case. This was too high stakes. The bird remains were in the ground. They couldn't bring him into court. So the special agents that raided the property asked Roxy to come with them. And so Roxy rode along. They raided the property together. As soon as it was secure, Roxy was brought into the yard, and she set up a little workbench on the back of a pickup truck, essentially. And her assistant, a woman named Beth Ann Sabo at the time, was standing next to the kill pit. Special agents were in there taking these decomposing bird carcasses out of the pit, putting them on a tray. Beth Ann would walk them over to Roxy, and she'd inspect them on the spot and log, you know, this is a barred owl, this is a red-tailed hawk. And on it went. And they identified, you know, I think close to 100 birds in one day from that pit.
So she brought the Kluge family to justice. But perhaps what she deserves to be remembered more for, apart from a colourful life, is she made aviation safer. And this, in your book, there's still these extraordinary stories of sort of a duck going through the windscreen of a Learjet in the 1980s. You know, this still going on?
Every day, all around the world. You know, I believe in the U.S. last year, we logged about 17,000 bird strikes. As part of reporting the book, I wanted to learn, and this is not in the book, but I was just so curious, like, how do airports manage this? So I spent a day with the team at Logan where that initial airplane crashed in 1960, they have a team of wildlife biologists that are essentially chasing birds all day, setting traps if need be, shooting them. This is a real, real issue. And, you know, I believe there's a lot of evidence indicating that a bird played a role in the tragic air crash in Korea in December that killed hundreds of people. You know, this is a problem. I think we're going to see more airplane disasters caused by bird strikes. You cannot get rid of birds. It's something that can only be managed and mitigated. But this is a real problem that aviation industry grapples with.
And so the forensic ornithology that she pioneered continues.
It sure does. And her, you know, I mentioned Carla Dove, but she's running this lab down in the Smithsonian still. And, you know, they're really, you know, big threat here is Air Force and military. These fighter jets are often a single jet engine. So if you sometimes commercial airliners have four engines, they lose one to a bird strike, they can still get back safely. If you got a single engine aircraft and that engine goes out because of a bird, that's a big problem. These air, you know, the military is also flying at extremely low altitudes where birds are more abundant, and they're flying at frightening speeds. So a bird strike, you know, something even small could be completely tragic for an Air Force pilot. So this is, you know, this is closely
it
monitored
matters.
By the military.
It matters.
Really does matter.
Chris, how on earth did they ever get Roxy out of her job? I can't believe that she would ever leave the lab. Why isn't she still there?
She really did almost work until the day she died. Her, you know, certainly her vision was diminishing as she got older, and that's not easy when you need to be staring through a microscope to make these identifications. But she was singular in her skill set, and she was just relentless in her work ethic. So she was never going to give up on this. This became her life. And she also did a wonderful job of bringing a few mentees along. So she mentored somebody who took over the FBI and crime work. She mentored another young woman who took over the poaching work. And then she mentored Carla Dove, who is still at the Smithsonian, kind of carrying the torch. But Roxy really did work essentially until the day she died.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Chris Sweeney, author of The Feather Detective, Mystery, Mayhem and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne, published by Simon & Schuster. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, the life and work of Emily Carmen Guare. Her painting life was short, only 8 years, but Emily Carmen Guare was one of this country's great painters. A blockbuster exhibition of her work was held at the National Gallery in 2024 and a retrospective at the Tate in London in 2025. We spoke at that time to the makers of the documentary Emily, I Am Calm.
producer Anna Grieve and the co-producer and screenwriter, a Luritja and Warramungu woman, Danielle McLean. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
How long have the pair of you wanted to make this film and why?
Good question. I worked at Karma in my 20s and my family actually worked with Emily Nwore. And so I was always really interested in her life and her story. So I could say since I was in my 20s, which is 30 years ago, but the exhibition itself, the National Gallery of Australia's exhibition, really motivated us to go, this is the right time to tell this story. So that was 3 years ago that we started that development.
And why is the story worth telling?
I think she's a really unique woman. She's lived a big life in the bush, and she's such an amazing, strong cultural woman, but that she could bridge those two worlds, you know, going from the bush and then, you know, really make people in the cities fall in love with her and her ideas of country and how she captured that on canvas. You know, I think that's pretty unique.
What about you, Anna?
I just also felt that it was incredible to make a film about a woman who, I mean, she did paint, you know, her life body painting, so and the batiks before she started on the oils. But I just thought it was incredible to show such a powerful woman culturally and in every other way working within her community, being so grounded in community. I think we needed access to that because it's certainly allowed me to see her paintings in a completely different way.
What was the power of the woman? Apart from being this astonishing painter, there is a power in the face, in the way she sits, in the way she walks. What is that power?
I think that's just, you know, being very self-confident and, you know, aware of her place in her society. She was a senior woman. She had a lot of authority around her and she didn't apologise for that. She was a really, you know, she carried those stories and that importance of passing that knowledge on. I think that's in her face, you know, the life she lives in her face, but also the power in her hands and her arms and stuff, the bush life she lived. Also translate into the power she uses in her paintings, how she puts the paint on the canvas.
This woman was, well, long dead before you began to make this film, but the archival footage you found, there she is hunting, there she is cooking. Where is this from?
Yeah, so we were really lucky actually, and Anna is a great researcher as well as producer, but we had other people that helped us research and find those materials. We worked with people who knew Emily very well and spent a lot of time with her in community. Julia Murray, you know, she was out there working on the ground with Emily, batiking and stuff, and so she recorded stuff that was kind of personal images of friendship and people in community, just living community lives. And I think that's what we really wanted to capture, not the professional life so much, but who she was as a human being and how she was considered in her own community.
There's a lot of dust in the documentary and Land Cruisers. Did she drive?
The story is that she learnt to drive. She never got her license. She sounds like she was a very crazy driver.
Yeah. She was very good on the runway, I think.
Yeah, there's a terrifying moment of sort of acceleration madly down a bush track. But she came to painting late, of course. This is the famous fact about Emily. But she had actually painted all her life in one way or another, hadn't she?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, moving to canvas, acrylic paints on canvas is really the story she was telling in body paint her whole life, you know, that you learn when you're a kid that people are doing that as senior, people are doing that to you. You learn to dance, you learn those stories and stuff. And then she was transferring that information onto other women's bodies when they dance ceremony and stuff. So those stories are being told over and over again, just in different mediums.
And there's a wonderful sequence in the documentary where one of the women from Utopia is walking past these pictures saying, emu, yam, seeds. It's, you know, this is what's
fascinating for a white fella like me is that those paintings moved me profoundly. In fact, I was swearing quite a lot of the time as I was watching the documentary. But I don't know the stories, and yet those pictures have a real punch for me. You don't have to know the story, do you? And yet the story is everything. How is that worked out?
No, I think it's actually about emotional intention and stuff as well, and connection. I think she was putting that energy and that paint on the canvas in a way almost like a ceremony to her country. And somehow that just comes out when you look at those images, you feel that power.
Anna, your thoughts?
She says in the film, and a number of people say, you know, she really believed that if she painted her country, that people would come to understand her country. And so that's sort of central to everything she's doing. I mean, even learning, you know, in paintings that the karma seeds change colour, and that you can see in a painting young women, you know, middle-aged women and older women through the different colour of the seeds. You know, all these things are sort of interconnected and really grounded in the place in which, you know, her family had lived for 65,000 years.
And she had no hesitation telling these stories. There was nothing private about them.
No, I think that's the thing. You know, people know what they're able to share. And if you spend time with women, and if you're, you know, a woman yourself, they will tell you other things, and there's layers of information that get passed. And, you know, we might just learn about a layer that's more like a childlike layer, the first layer. And then you know, as you learn more, as you get older, you learn more story and more detail about being a woman, about these ceremonial stories.
Anna?
Oh, I just think absolutely, you know, the connection, you know, as a white woman, you know, going into that female community, you really feel that if you're in for the long haul, and you know, you develop trust over a period of time, you are given it's a very open sort of offering to you. It's not a closed thing. It's just you know, it's just a connection that they will make over time, and particularly when their first language is not English, so you're also, you know, finding the connection through that.
And I think you're right, though, Anna, like the Ilulgra and Anungra ladies, the Ilulgra being Emily's country and Anungra being the brother country that, you know, shares ceremony. I think those ladies that we worked with were so generous with us and, you know, so willing to share. Obviously, Emily's passed a long time ago, and we really wanted to work with them to check that we're doing the right thing, that they were really happy for her image and her voice and stuff. And they were so generous in that. But I think they know that that's also keeping culture alive, and that this woman, that's her legacy as well, that, you know, this film is her legacy, that she can share that culture with the younger generation.
Oh, yes. But now tell me, how is it that women in the centre of Australia, in the dusty centre of Australia, are working lengths of silk, doing something that seems to be from the culture of Indonesia, batik. How does batik get to Utopia?
Well, I think in the first instance, through Jenny Green coming out there and wanting to do some sort of cross-cultural workshops, and that she brought Julia Murray out, and the two of the women and some other women, including Deborah Speedy, actually introduced batik to the community. And you know, there is a funny scene in the film because, you know, it's a lot of very intensive, labour-intensive work.
Yes.
They had to all use up all their washing powder in the 40-gallon drum to wash the silks and stuff.
But boiling over fires.
And now they're hanging, you know, in the National Gallery or in the Tate, you know.
Oh, but first there's a sequence in the documentary where the women are holding these lengths of batik and yes, they're drying in the wind.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's just extraordinary.
It is. They're gorgeous, aren't they, too? They're just the way they cap the colour and the movement, and but they're all capturing all those things of the bush life, you know, like Anna said, the food, the ceremonial stuff, the women's awulia. They're all those stories are in their batiks, and then they move into canvas.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Daniel McLean and Anna Grieve about their documentary, Emily, I Am Karma. Now, how was it that Emily was finally sitting in front of sheets of canvas with acrylic paint. And I take it that she had no worries whatever about authenticity or any considerations of that kind. This was a new way of painting. But how come?
So CARMA, so Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association, was asked by ATSIC at the time to take over the running of the Utopia Women's Batik Group. And Rodney Gooch was working for CARMA at the time.
And who was he?
So Rodney was, he was just a the manager at CARMA at the time of the Art Centre. And they worked, I think the story goes, they were working with the women with batiks, but batiks cost so much to produce and they are actually quite difficult to make in
and
the bush.
Didn't fetch much money on the market.
No, that's right. And so then there was this idea that they would move to canvas and see what they could. They took out lots of canvases. I think it was something 90 canvases out bush and dropped them off to women across, you know, the Utopia region, so the Sandover region actually, in different various communities and outstations. And then they went back at Christmas time and picked them up and they got back, I think they, what did they say they got back, Anna?
I think they got back 81 works and I think 79 were by women and they're the ones that were exhibited as a series that then became the summer series, which is a was at the opening of the National Gallery and it is owned by Holmes of Court, Janet Holmes of Court Collection, who were very generous because in making this film, in, not financially, but in the sense of they had photographed a lot of the batiks and a lot of the works and they own the entire summer collection. They bought it as one series. So that sort of inspired the whole community to get painting.
And yeah, I think the thing was before that, there was obviously the Papunyachula artists and a lot of them were men. And so this was kind of the first time that women were working on canvas, you know, and as it says in the film, you know, there were certain women that really stood out, you know, the Ada Birds, the, you know, Emily Nguare, you know, those women really stood out amongst that group. Not saying that any of the other work wasn't beautiful as well, but they had their own unique styles. And so that's how her kind of career grew because people identified her as a unique artist that could paint and was wanted to paint. Sounds like, you know, painting made her happy.
And she went about it with such force. There's such wonderful footage of her slamming the brush down onto the canvas. It's not a dainty business.
No. I think she really owns it, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah. But when did the art market start to pay attention to this name and in the art market known just as Emily?
I think after the summer series, it was quite quick that they actually identified her as a solo artist. She started to be in exhibitions and she travelled, her work travelled, she didn't travel, but her work travelled around Australia particularly in those early days. So it didn't take a long time. And one of, you know, her first painting gets chosen to be on the front of the catalogue, you know, Emu Woman. So the very first time she works on canvas, you know, she's identified as this unique artist that's got something to say or something that, you know, as Hetty Perkins says, you know, it draws people to it. So, you know, that energy or that kind of connection between the audience that's looking at the work and the producer is already there. I think that's the thing, she could do that quite early on.
What about you, Anna?
Her trajectory, you know, and coincided with a sort of the growth of an international art market, you know, trajectory in terms of First Nations art. So she sort of was at the foreground and something about her work which just really found a resonance with, you know, the white market. It absolutely did. And, you know, these things within the art market, once things start rolling and she's producing more work, it just, it's commanding higher and higher prices at auctions and it sort of builds. But I think fundamentally there was a connection in her work. It was partly maybe to do with her age when she started on acrylics, but she was freer. She wasn't trying to echo anyone except herself.
Yeah, so I think there's a real sense of authority to her work and no apologies. This is who I am. This is what I paint.
And there were so many different ways that she painted.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right. Over her career, she painted quite a few different styles, but they always came back to Ulalagra, you know, like always to country.
Now, you say that she didn't travel, but she did travel, and one of her trips was to Canberra. Why was she going there?
For the Paul Keating Arts Fellowship.
She got a Keating, as we used to say, and here she is describing getting a Keating. When translated, I was there at that place, Canberra, that's me, and that's the one giving me an award. That man, I don't know his name, that was the first time I seen him. Jenny Green, you say his name, Paul Keating. Yes, Paul Keating, he gave me the money from painting. And that was a famous moment because all of that congratulation and real sort of celebration in Australia that Emily had won this fellowship. She declared, didn't she, that she would now give up painting.
That's right. She said she was going to give it up. I think she was tired and thought she would be able to give it up and that, you know, this little bit of money would help her to retire.
But she didn't, did she?
She didn't give up. Yeah. And I think that drive to keep painting and her obligations to the art world, because everyone wanted her art, but also to her family and stuff, she knew she was supporting a lot of people, and that was done in a completely generous way, and her cultural responsibility to those people meant she could, you know, keep painting and provide for lots of people in her community.
Is it clear what she thought of the white world and what she thought of the applause of the white world?
No, I don't think she necessarily needed it, but I actually do think she understood that she was famous. You know, she had that sense of authority and she understood people wanted her work and that by doing this, she was looking after country, not only in the ceremonial sense, but actually bringing stories to the greater white world to understand you need to protect my country. So I think she understood that. She definitely wasn't a stupid woman. She knew about her own worth and the power of her work. So,
but she didn't prioritise, as probably, you know, a white artist might, her own comforts. You know, she still lived in pretty, you know, tough old conditions out there, you know, under a bit of corrugated iron and literally, you know, looking at all the footage, you know, it wasn't just for self-benefit, the painting, it was for the whole community.
Yes, I kept looking in the documentary for her house. I mean, where is her house? And surely with all of this money, there is a house. But the documentary continued to show slabs of corrugated iron. Is that how she lived?
It is. I believe that is how she lived. And then she, you know, as she got older and stuff, she did do stints, I think, in Adelaide and with other family members who may have been selling her art or working with other artists and stuff as well. But she did live a very simple life. I mean, housing in communities is still a huge issue, but there's overcrowding, all those things. But also people want their own space, and those women camps, where women live together without, you know, when they get to a certain age and they haven't got the children and the husbands and stuff like that, they have that sense of community and that there are other women there looking after them and as well. So
yeah, Lily, her friend, you know, she spent many years, you know, with Emily, you know, helping her with the cooking, and, you know, other women in the community would bring her water, cooking, creating fires, bringing food. It was a very... older women and younger women seem to really take care of each other.
Yeah, I think that is the obligation to each other, and that family, you're in together, you're around a campfire, you're, you know, that's the place you gather. And, people's lives are very simple in the bush, you know, and sometimes they're very difficult as well. There's no denying that. But there is also this thing that they're together and there's this sense of family and community and everyone, you know, you're not sent off to an old people's home, you're actually still there and people care about you.
You were able to film members of her family and community coming to the National Gallery and seeing last year's exhibition for the first time. What was your sense of that?
Oh, look, I think it was really special and powerful for the ladies. Obviously, at the start of the doco, we talk about, we sort of make a promise to them, and Kelly Cole and Hetty Perkins say, you know, you'll get to come to the exhibition and you'll get to see it first, when they're saying this is what we want to do. And then they do that, and we're there with them when they see those paintings. And they talk about actually how strong they felt about their culture, but also about her presence, and that they felt that she was there with them, which I think is really, really beautiful. And as you say, it's a very much like, that's the Yamsi, that's the Woman's Awulia, this is all a Lalgra. They can read the paintings, they walk through the space, this is ours, basically, is what they're saying. They connect to them.
But they were really, it was just fantastic to see how empowered they were by having the paintings, being in there surrounded by the paintings and by everything that had happened. I mean, they were really, it was very emotional for them.
Was it your feeling as well? I know so many people felt this, that they thought they knew Emily's work before that exhibition, but that exhibition revealed so much more and so much that was unexpected.
Absolutely. I think it's a journey, the whole, you know, how much she painted in such a short period of time, and to watch how her style is constantly evolving, you know, in each room until you get to sort of, you know, the giant Yam painting, which is owned by the National Gallery of Victoria, you know, such an epic painting that we've watched her paint on the ground, you know, in the sitting in the centre of the canvas on a big ground. It was overwhelming, and it was a great privilege we had, because we could spend so long staring at paintings inside that exhibition space while we're doing interviews, so that we could really absorb them. And just the colour and the richness of them was, it just really stays with you.
Is it the same exhibition that's about to open in the Tate?
It is based on the exhibition that Kelly Cole and Hetty Perkins curated. Kelly is actually the curator of the Tate exhibition, and it's based on that. But because these paintings, you know, obviously have to travel so far to get to the UK, so what they've done is picked up different paintings that they couldn't get for the Australian exhibition. So it's based off it, but there'll be other pieces that we didn't see here, and they won't see some of the pieces that we had in this, our local exhibition.
Worth a journey, as they used to say in the guidebooks.
I think so. I'd love to be there.
Yeah.
Now, I take it, Daniel and Anna, you're both collectors of Emily's work. Why are you laughing?
We're documentary filmmakers. I mean, Danielle was very lucky to have a work very, you know, early on from a long time ago. But I think, you know, the life of a documentary filmmaker doesn't stretch to the I have to say I have a cushion cover from the National Gallery.
Excellent. It's a start. Danielle and Anna, thank you so much for joining me on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Danielle McLean, screenwriter, director and co-producer of the documentary, and Anna Grieve, the producer. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, we tangle with the Indigenous concept of deep history, a way of understanding millennia of history on this continent. Plus, we look at the history, philosophy and future of shade.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.